So yeah, as Yinchen said, I'm gonna share with you some hopefully soon to appear results that I'm doing, getting in progress with my excellent collaborators, Shang Liu, who's a postdoc at KITP, and Max Mitlitsky, who's a faculty at MIT. So the goal is to study a very simple kind of line defect in the Ising CFT in general dimensions. And the main result I'm going to share with you today is about the D equals 3 case, where we can really exploit the power of bootstrap to get precise critical exponents and other things. So just to give you an outline of my talk, I will first just motivate and set up the problem. Then I will discuss mostly analytic results about this defect from dimensions 2 through 4. I will then describe how we are applying conformal bootstrap to this problem. And I will conclude with some final remarks, future directions, etc. So I'm interested mostly in condensed matter physics. So when I think of conformal field theories, I'm usually thinking about some lattice model as describing the UV degrees of freedom. And so the general setup of the problem that I'm going to be talking about is we're going to have some bulk system, which could be described by some Hamiltonian H naught that lives on some d-dimensional lattice. And we're going to take this system, and we're going to do something to it along some localized region. So just not on the full system. So such problems have been studied for many, many decades, going back to things like Kondo problem, which is relevant to magnetic impurities in metals, and just general impurity problems. These were studied by lots of people, but for sort of these kinds of problems really led to a lot of exciting developments in theoretical physics, like the renormalization group, etc. You can also have sort of simple kinds of defects where you just change some couplings along this subregion and ask if there are new phases that you get that emerge sort of on the defect. And you can also talk about symmetry defects. These are sort of maybe external probes that you can add to the system related to turning on some background flux. And oftentimes they lead to different spectra and especially different symmetry properties when maybe there's an anomaly or something. So in my past work, I was thinking about these sorts of things. So in general, no matter what kind of defect we have, we want to understand its long distance properties. And well, in this talk, I want to develop some more tools to do this. So the concrete context in which I'm going to be thinking about in this talk is the following question. So suppose we have a one-dimensional system with, you know, the usual assumptions, locality, finiteness of excitation and local excitation energies, etc. We can ask if we can get the system to spontaneously order. And in a general one-dimensional system, the answer is no. So it's well known that in the Ising one-dimensional statistical Ising model, there's no phase transition. And the reason is because domain walls are favored relative to the fully ordered phase, and they proliferate and destroy the order. So what I'm going to do here is ask if we instead consider a higher dimensional system. And then in this system, we do something along some line, let's say. So I'm going to be mostly focusing on line defects. We can tune the interaction strength to be very strong and try to force spontaneous symmetry breaking of the spins along this line. So in other words, if we measure the magnetization near the line, it should have long range order. And so what we'd hope is that there's some phase where this actually happens, and so we don't have to make k infinite in order to get like this kind of effect. And by the way, I should say, please interrupt me with any questions that you have. So as I alluded to in this talk, I'm going to mostly focus on this problem, or study this problem from a field theory point of view. So what we can imagine is that we have taken our system, which is going to be some Ising spins, and we've tuned the bulk to the critical point. And well, we know that this critical point has a conformal field theory description. And so we wanna study the different phases that we get when we add different kinds of defects, like this symmetry breaking term or other sorts of things. So what can happen at long distances is that the system can flow to something called a defect conformal field theory, or some fixed point where which is really some fixed point where you still preserve some conformal symmetry, namely the conformal symmetry that preserves the location of the line, but all the other conformal symmetry is broken. So when this happens, a lot of different things can occur that are distinct from what happens just when you have the bulk. So if you look at correlation functions of bulk operators, they will have dramatically different properties due to the presence of the defect. For instance, bulk one-point function, bulk operators now get a one-point function, generally. And then further, there are new critical exponents associated with measuring things near the defect. So, so we can have new operators that we can insert on this defect, measure their correlation functions, and discover these new properties. So a really important thing that was sort of recently discovered about defects, and this is sort of going to be important for the rest of my talk, is that defect RG flows are constrained by certain monotonicity theorems. So in this talk, I'm going to be mostly thinking about starting from some bulk fixed point described by a CFT, and then adding some operator along a line defect that is relevant for the lines. That means the scaling dimension is less than one. And when you do this, what people showed fairly recently, these authors finally did it conclusively, is that you can define a function called G, defined in this way, which has the property that it decreases along this defect RG flow. So there are some subtleties defining this G. You have to remove some counter terms sometimes if you're not at a fixed point. But at the fixed point, we really just care about the constant piece of this whole quantity, and that's what this G is really. So it's an important quantity that characterizes the defect. It's kind of like a free energy difference associated with having the defect versus having not having the defect. And it measures some number of degrees of freedom on this defect. But interestingly, it can be less than one, and so you're like, how can I have negative degrees of freedom? But somehow, there's some leaking into the bulk, so it's kind of interesting. So I should say that like in D equals 2, since conformal defects are basically identical to conformal boundary conditions, this result follows from, what was finally proved about the Affleck-Ludwig boundary G function. And then in higher dimensions, as I said, this is proved more recently.
This is about line defects.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I think the status of higher dimensional defects is still perhaps more unknown, but I don't quite remember.
This G function is defined in general dimension or in two dimensions?
Yeah. This G function is defined for any line defect in any dimension. But it just has to be a line defect.
Yes, but in that situation, for example, in 3D, how do you define the particular function there for CFT?
Well, you can... Right, so I sort of glossed over some details, but so I think what you should really do is, I think this works in general. I think if you're really at a CFT, then it sort of matters a lot less. But in general, I think you should take space to be like a sphere, a D-sphere or something like that, and then take this defect to wrap around the equator of this D-sphere or something. And then, yeah, you can also take it to wrap around SD plus one or something. I mean, but yeah, there are some constraints, geometrical constraints that you should be careful about when you're defining this in like, you know, outside of a pure CFT, but yes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so so when we have these defects, as I said, there can be new operators. But not only can there be new operators that just live on the defect, but there are new excitations that occur when you consider two defects joined together. So if you let's first imagine that we have a spacetime like SD times R, and we can imagine placing two conformal defects at antipodal points of the SD. Under the usual operator state mapping, this maps to a straight line defect, where at the origin, there's a junction between these two defects of possibly different type. So we can call the space of states describing these primary fields as some defect Hilbert space. And we'll call the operators living at these junctions defect changing operators. So these defect changing operators obey pretty much all the normal constraints that a 1D primary field would obey. We just have some new labels that we need to keep track of that give us new possibilities in correlation functions and stuff. So an important thing to note is that if our theory has a symmetry, a global symmetry in the bulk, then we should also understand how it interacts with the defect. So in general, this story is kind of under development, I think. There's a lot of like math literature that's being devoted to studying this kind of thing. But in this talk, and you know, it goes under the name of like higher representations and fancy stuff like that, but in this talk, it's kind of very simple. I just have a Z2 symmetry, and so I don't really need to get too fancy. But basically, the idea is that if we take a defect of one type and then insert a bulk symmetry defect, then in order for the symmetry defects to be topological at the junction here, the defect on the other side when we cross the junction needs to be the image of the defect itself under this transformation. If this defect would be of the same type as this one, then we'd actually have an excitation localized at, well, possibly an excitation localized at this junction if the defect type should actually change. We're gonna use this a lot. The setup that I introduced was that we had spontaneous symmetry breaking on a line defect, or that was the situation we were trying to cook up. In this talk, actually, I'm going to be really studying defects where I explicitly break the symmetry. But I want to motivate what's exactly the relation between these two things. I'm still personally kind of confused about how to see this on the lattice, but at least in CFT, I can convince myself that it's true. So let's say we imagined we had some fixed point conformal defect that had long range order for Z2 symmetry breaking. So some general properties we'd expect from this thing are that it would be Z2 symmetric, and it would have two vacua corresponding to each symmetry broken state, plus and minus, we could say. There's an order parameter for this, which is the difference of these topological operators for this defect, and it has long range order when we look at its connected two-point function. So this is what we'd call symmetry breaking. So on this symmetry broken defect, we would expect both local and domain wall excitations to occur. And so if we think about the Hilbert space of operators that live on this defect, we would have operators which are defect operators in the plus plus vacuum, domain walls, and we'd have defect operators in the minus minus vacuum. So what I'm going to do in this talk is just study each of these Hilbert spaces separately by applying a symmetry, explicit symmetry breaking perturbation. And then in the end, we say that whatever fixed point we get that corresponds to explicit symmetry breaking, we just take the direct sum of all these different sectors, domain walls and otherwise, and then we could obtain a possibly unstable symmetry broken defect. Spontaneous symmetry broken defect.
Very right.
Yeah.
I just have a question regarding the domain walls. So like the Hilbert spaces there, by domain wall, you mean like the junction between the two.
That's right.
So I was wondering, like, why not? I thought because you have two lines, mm-hmm. and you preserve rotation basically in the d direction, perpendicular to the lines, then you can swap them, right? So I thought there's it's just one copy of that Hilbert space.
Sure, but well, you. I think. I mean, yeah, they're kind of dual to each other, but I think technically they'd be still separate.
Okay, so you're thinking
they're literally dual to each other. So the ones in here would be the Hermitian conjugates, basically, of the ones in the other one.
Okay.
So, because you sort of do need to keep track of the orientation or the ordering of operators. Like, you can't just really, like. There's a reflection symmetry about the defect, and so that also implements this transformation. But like, yeah, I don't want to think about rotations really, probably. So,
sorry, can you say again? Plus one is what is that one? Sorry.
Right. So it's like you have. Well, I'm going to show it. Oh wait. There we go. Wait, did I? Oh yeah. Okay, that's the next slide. Yeah. So yeah, here maybe pictures will be helpful. So, yeah. So in the context of this. Are there any more questions about this last slide? Okay, good. So yeah. So in this talk with this setup with this pinning field.
Perhaps an observation that the way to motivate this formula is just to say I take these other parameters and I make them into projectors. Hmm. So I have a space of all things, and then I have projectors on order parameter 1 or order parameter minus 1 mm-hmm. at each individual defect. And so I get 4 sectors, mm-hmm. 4 projectors, 4 orthogonal projectors.
Okay, right, yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense, yeah.
So you normalize your I plot, your I, so that it's the script 1 and then 1 minus I is a projector. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So in the context of this defect that we're going to be studying in this talk, where, essentially we have a defect where we explicitly break some symmetry, we'll call it the pinning field defect. We'll have bulk operators, which I'm mostly going to think of as being operators living on the trivial defect. And then we have these genuine defect operators, which I think answers your question. So we have an operator which sits at a junction between two of the same defect type, either plus or minus. We have endpoints, which are junctions between this pinning field defect and nothing. And then we have domain walls, which where the sign of the pinning field changes across the defect.
Just make sure I didn't miss anything. So on the lattice, a line with plus minus presumably means all up, plus minus all down, or is that?
Well, on the lattice, if you wanted to really get this, then you'd apply a symmetry breaking field in the plus direction in like half of the lattice, and then in the minus direction in the other half of the lattice to force. Yeah, you're forcing it to be in this particular configuration.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, you no. Okay. Sure.
So it's not. I'm guessing plus and minus are the most convenient types of defects to focus on, but it, for for something more complicated than 2D icing, mm-hmm. it's not known that those are the only two types.
Oh, well, if you're going beyond 2D, well, in 3D icing, well, there's this one, there's this symmetry broken defect, or fixed defect, really, I should call it. There's also like the Menagerie defect. And then, let's see, beyond that, I don't know if there's any more. there could be some really weird unstable ones where you just crank up some irrelevant operator, and that could maybe lead to a new fixed point or something, but yeah, I don't.
Yeah, I was thinking of like recent papers talking about new types of defects being discovered all the time, like
in the icing model.
In OOM, there's this extraordinary log phase.
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah. In for other CFTs, there are definitely more defects.
It's worth saying that. I mean, classifying defects in dimensional algorithm one is hopeless because it's as complicated as 2D theories. Classification of line defects should be possible, but nobody knows how to do it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'll just state my goals for the rest of the talk. We're going to be studying this pinning field defect, and in different dimensions. This is not a new problem by any means. So going back almost 30 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, it really was there was work done analytically by Sachdev and Alais. There's also Monte Carlo work that was done studying this thing. There was some bootstrap work that was done, but the results were fairly inconclusive. But very recently, people here have been studying this with Fuzzy Sphere. And so for those of you who are doing this, I apologize. I might tell you nothing that you don't know already. But on the other hand, I think actually what I can do is maybe convince you that the results you're getting are quite reasonable. So in the rest of the talk, I want to show how to really exploit the power of conformal bootstrap to get to study this defect. There have been a lot of really nice works done trying to study this sort of similar problems in the past, both in the context of boundaries and in the context of line defects. So there are sort of two things that you can mostly try. So you can either impose this bulk to boundary crossing symmetry. So in principle, this is a very powerful constraint. But unfortunately, it suffers from a problem when you try to do numerical bootstrap, which is that it doesn't have the right positivity properties. So you can try to get around this sometimes by making some assumptions or using sort of technically non-rigorous approaches So various nice results have been obtained this way. You can also study, and also the benefit of this is that you really actually do reference the bulk. You would really think that the bulk is an important ingredient when you're studying line defects in a given CFT. You can also try to do this kind of bootstrap where you impose four-point crossing symmetry on correlation functions of these defect localized operators. So this has the benefit of being able to has all the right positivity properties, so you can do standard numerical bootstrap tricks. Unfortunately, it really makes no reference to the bulk whatsoever. And so the bounds you get are sort of just apparently way too general, typically. And it's hard to make any conclusive statements. So in this talk, I'm going to basically do essentially this thing, where we pose four-point crossing symmetry. But we're just going to add some new ingredients. We're going to add these defect-changing operators, and we're going to see what we get. Okay, so well, maybe I should pause for if there's any other questions so far. Okay. So I'll now just review some of the known results, starting in D equals 2, where we have full analytical control. So in D equals 2, this pinning field defect is actually quite simple. The general case of conformal defects in the 2D icing model are still fully known. They're related to boundary conditions of free boson in the orbifold branch. We don't need to go to this like sort of more complicated description even to describe the spinning field defect, because it turns out that in the spinning field defect in two dimensions, it really just acts as something which cuts the system and then imposes fixed boundary conditions on either side of the cut. So in order to study it, we can use the folding trick, but there's no gluing when we do the folding trick. There's just cutting, and so it's really just like we have two copies of icing here with some tensor product boundary condition, so it's quite nice. In the icing CFT, there are three conformal boundary states. The ones that are relevant here, or simple ones at least, the ones that are relevant here are the fixed boundary conditions, which have this description in terms of Cardy states. What this means exactly is not so important, but basically the coefficients of each of these terms tell you the one-point function on the disk of the corresponding primary fields, 0, epsilon, and sigma. So when we go to this icing squared theory with this tensor product boundary condition, we can describe it using Cardy states as a tensor product of the Cardy states for each copy. And one thing we can do now is read off what the defect entropy is. It's G, and it's equal to 1/2. And so this picture is like we basically impose this boundary condition like on the inside of the disk, but then we unfold it to create the actual defect instead of the boundary condition. And this configuration gives us G. To compute the spectrum of operators, we can for instance look at the partition functions. So we have some defect, so we want to compute its torus partition function because we have a closed ring system with two defects inserted along the ring. So we have the defect partition function, which is the square of the vacuum icing character. We have the plus or minus the domain wall partition function, which is the square of the 1/2 icing character. And we also have the endpoint. And this one behaves slightly differently because we don't really need to even fold. We can just sort of unwrap. And that's just the single icing character. So the spectra are as follows. So in the defect sector, we have the identity operator, and then we have operators of integer dimension starting at 2. From all the descendants. The domain wall sector is pretty similar. We just have all integers greater than 1. And for the endpoints, you have to sort of relate the torus Hamiltonian to the disk Hamiltonian and then solve some simple condition on what the scaling dimensions should be. And when you do this, you find that there are two towers of states. There's one associated with this first tower where we take the ground state and then add an integer. And then there's another tower where we have half integers plus the ground state energy. And so we're scaling dimension. And so in particular, the lightest endpoint dimension is 1/32nd, which is quite small.
What do all this mean for the stability of the solution breaking defect?
That's good. That's a good question. So the lightest local excitation is dimension 2. So it's very irrelevant. So this thing is very stable to local excitations. But the lightest defect, the lightest domain wall excitation is exactly marginal. And so basically there's a line of these defects tuned by this marginal parameter, and this particular defect sits at the end of this line, and it does have stable spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Right. So if I move along the marginal direction, mm-hmm. I have SSB all the way.
I think at the end, then it is, and then I think the domain wall stays marginal throughout the whole line.
Okay.
But I think it may not be true that the other defects are non-simple, but actually, yeah, I need to look that up. Sorry.
I also think it's just like endpoint. Like when you tune like the defect trends to infinity, you get a symmetry break. But along that line, you still get all the way conform defects, but they are not symmetry break.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Sorry, I'm just to confirm, is that the spins, the notation in the super, like, superscript?
The superscripts refer to, so back here, we have different defect types.
Right.
So basically we're considering junctions between different line defects, all junctions between either the trivial defect or the defect where we fix the spins to be plus or minus, okay? And so, yeah, so that's what that means. So here we're talking about the scaling dimension of these domain walls or endpoints or just these defect operators. Yeah.
Sorry, how do I think of the two sectors in the endpoint?
How do I think of these?
These two towers.
Well, like, what do you mean? Like, in what sense?
Like, why are there two towers, essentially?
Why are there, there are two towers because here we have the spectrum of energies is exactly the spectrum of energies of the Ising model on the interval with fixed boundary conditions. But so you can imagine, so basically like one way to take this make the endpoint is to take the half plane, which is like the conformally equivalent to this interval, and then you basically do a z-squared transformation. And then you map the half plane to like a semi-infinite line. And then basically, when you do this mapping, then when you like compare the energies and find the relation between the scaling dimensions, they have to, some of them get divided by two because of this map. So that's where the halves are coming from. But here, like, you divide the length by two and you also do the folding. So you don't have this this effect. Okay, so we can also study this defect perturbatively in close to four dimensions. We could do some epsilon expansion. I should really have some citations here, I'm sorry. But I've cited these people earlier, but a lot of these calculations were done by Sashdev, and then more recently by Cuomo and so Kramer-Gutsky and Avir Moshe. In 4 minus epsilon dimensions, we will be studying the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, and we'll be adding an explicit symmetry breaking term here. I should note that like in order to create these domain walls, endpoints, etc., we can consider different profiles for this coupling. So we can either turn it off or change its sign at any point. When you study this problem, you can compute the fixed point of the bulk, and there's a fixed point of the defect. And it's sort of interesting because in order to compute the defect fixed point, you can't assume that h is perturbatively small. And indeed, the fixed point starts at like h equals, 3 here. So the way that the Dagger Max works out is that for any order in lambda, there are only finitely many H insertions that you can have, and so it still kind of works out. One thing that you get out of this is scaling dimension of the lightest defect operator. And again, this is from the paper by Cuomo and all et al. And if you look at this, there's sort of a very large epsilon squared correction. So it looks a bit dicey. But what they did, which is really nice and observed, is that if you do some Bede approximate technique and basically fix fix, you know, you have some approximation for the true value of this defect along the along a continuous line ranging from 2 to 4 in the dimension. When you do a Pade approximate and set the known d equals 2 and d equals 4 results and solve for the resulting Pade approximate, you find that actually all of the different approximates are quite close, and they arrive at this estimate here for this defect operator.
This is just using these three terms in this Taylor series and the d equals 2 result.
That's right. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Okay, so you can also do the same. You can also do similar things for the endpoints and for the domain walls. So this the endpoint dimension was computed by Sachdev and Alais, and they find this expression, and then in d equals 3, it's equal to roughly 0.23 in epsilon expansion. I don't know of any published results about the domain wall case, but these calculations were done by Shang and Max, and they found that the domain wall has a scaling dimension of 1.17 in d equals 3. So these calculations, we've only gone to order epsilon. So you can't really trust any resummation yet, probably. And they have these, you know, they have these quite large corrections at leading order. So, we'll see. Probably you should take these with a grain of salt. So, but nonetheless, close to d equals 4, they're still right. And near d equals 4, we see that the domain wall is quite relevant. So now in 2D, we have this marginal domain wall. And then 3D, we don't quite know yet. And then in 4D, it becomes very relevant. But, well, actually, if we tune exactly to 4D and study exactly the Gaussian fixed point, then actually the perturbation is, again, marginal. And there is a phase where the domain wall can be made arbitrarily large scaling dimension. But maybe this is kind of bad from a point of view of universality, because any interaction in the bulk would cause a very slow flow of this of the defect coupling back to zero. So it's not truly maybe stable, you'd say. Okay, so now before I talk about Bootstrap, I'll just present a survey of all the various results that we have about various quantities characterizing the defect. So we have all these estimates here from epsilon expansion. In particular, the authors Cuomo et al. Computed the defect entropy. We also have various Monte Carlo results of seemingly varying quality, but nonetheless, they all appear roughly in the same range. Here we have some published results about fuzzy sphere, and we have various unpublished results, which I found from Yijian's talk here from the other day. So I was debating whether it was appropriate to put them in, but I think you'll find it interesting in the end. So I put them in. So just to keep this in the back of your mind. So now let's try to see what happens when we do Bootstrap. So to set up the Bootstrap problem, we really just need to study symmetry. So we need to consider space-time symmetries and internal symmetries, and we need to derive really all the selection rules that the correlation functions of all these operators that we're considering must obey. So again, we're going to be considering a straight line defect, and we're going to say that it lives along the tau axis. So when we're in 3D, we can imagine coordinates being labeled by tau, x, and y. So here we'll have we'll have a assume a continuous space-time symmetry given by this group, where we have an SL2R, which is the basically the transformations which act as genuine space-time symmetries of the defect. But of course, when you're off the defect, all of these are space genuine space-time symmetries. And then this part, the SO2 tau, which is rotations about the tau axis. These are really like internal symmetries when you're sitting right at the defect, but again, for bulk operators, they would be space-time symmetries again, generally. We also have some discrete space-time symmetry that will be important, which is reflections along the tau axis. And we have a discrete internal symmetry, which is the Ising Z2 symmetry. So I'll talk a bit about some things related to correlation functions of these defect changing operators. So generally, we're going to be imagining a situation where we have correlation functions of defect changing operators, and so we're going to want to use their OPE. So when we have defect type of like type AB going to BC, then when we do the OPE, we expand these into defects of type AC. And of course, the SL2R symmetry fixes the form of this OPE up to all the OPE coefficients of the highest weight states to be of this form. These terms capture basically all the descendant contributions, and these coefficients are completely known. And I should say, actually, a lot of this formalism was developed in this really nice thesis by Ingo Runkel back like in 2000. So you can really just look there to figure out how this all works. But in that case, it was studied in the context of boundary CFT in 2D. So something we need to be careful about is normalization of operators. So if we take a two-point function of some operators of type AB going to BA, then it would be allowed that the identity operator could appear. And this identity operator would fix the normalization of these operators, yet this term. But we need to be careful because, well, in a CFT, the way we can really just define G is just the expectation value of an infinite line defect and when we're in flat space. And so this expectation value is defined as, well, G is defined as this expectation value. And generally, it's not equal to 1. So we further note that the SL2R symmetry can cyclically permute correlation insertions of these operators in a correlation function. And so in particular, if we have a two-point function, we can choose to map the two points that define this two-point function to 0 or 1 in two different ways. And so this gives a relation between correlation functions where the B defect is on the inside versus on the outside. So you get some relation between these combinations of the identity OPE coefficient and G's for each of these different defect types. So this relation isn't super important for this, but in order to get unit normalization of these operators, let's say you can just choose this identity, the lambda corresponding to the identity equal to inverse G. We can also study three-point functions, and again, the SL2R symmetry gives us more constraints. So basically, when we cyclically permute the defects, all the OPE coefficients must be related, like this. And if we look at the cross ratio dependent part of the four-point function, we can get an expansion in terms of conformal blocks of this form. And so from almost all of the operators appearing in this expansion, this normalization factor of the operator O will be equal to 1. But importantly, the normalization factor for the identity will be equal to G. And so for the identity conformal block, we will have a factor of G when this identity operator appears. So this will be how G enters in Bootstrap. So now we should impose some symmetries. So I think it's clear by now, but we have this Ising symmetry. It transforms the line of type plus minus or of type plus or minus to type minus or plus when we sweep it past. And so basically all insertions of operators on this line will transform in kind of the obvious way where we pretty much just swap the plus and minus labels on all of them. Symmetry is broken, so we don't really need to worry about any charge of these operators when we do this. It's really just a swap of labels. But if we have some bulk operators, then there's a relation because, there's a relation between if we had a correlation function of some finite segment of defect with some bulk operator to a finite segment of defect of the opposite sign with the same defect operator. These two correlation functions must be related by a minus sign if the operator is charged. So this should indicate that when we consider correlation functions of some finite segments of these defects with bulk operators, the correlation functions will be sensitive to the charge of the bulk operator. So there are various additional selection rules that come from imposing the remaining spacetime symmetries. What we're going to assume is that the leading endpoint operator is an SO2 singlet. So this is the SO2 of the transverse rotations around the defect. We're also going to be considering correlation functions of the leading even scale bulk scalar, which is epsilon. It's like the energy operator, as well as the odd scalar, which is the bulk sigma, the order parameter. In the past, when people studied sort of this defect, they pretty much just used the displacement operator, which is a certain universal operator that lives on conformal defects, which whose integrals give you basically displacements. So they can get some universal bounds on conformal defects, which are very nice. But it turns out that if you include this operator in the system of correlation functions that I'll show, it really makes no difference. Although technically, it would allow you to have some sensitivity to higher transverse spin operators. But we're already having some issues with the spectrum extraction for just this system, so it's not even sure how we'd if it would. Well, we have to do some more work on that. And then there are also these parity constraints. So I'm going to call the SO2 spin of the defect of the transverse rotations. I'm going to call the quantum number S. There's also a Z2 parity that I'm going to call, whose quantum number I'm going to call P tau. And then I should also keep track of the bulk spin, the bulk SO3 spin of bulk operators, which I'll call L. One thing we should note is just how to compute the Z2 tau parity of bulk operators. And it's related to basically the spin plus the bulk parity eigenvalue of these operators. In order to get a p tau equals zero operator, you could either take an odd spin, odd bulk parity operator, so you contract some spin odd spin L symmetric tensor with like an epsilon tensor or something like that. Or you could consider even spin, even parity operators, and so on and so on. Now our goal is to basically put in as much bulk data going forward as possible, which we can get from various sources, including Bootstrap, various Bootstrap sources, as well as the recent fuzzy sphere data. And we will use this as really the starting point for all the calculations. I should say that like basically our definition of the 3D Ising model for the purposes of this talk is what's given by the navigator functional method, at least reported in this paper by Ning Su. One thing that's on our to-do list is to actually see how much the estimates we get of various quantities depends on the particular values of the bulk data that we put in. But given how precise the 3D CFT results are these days, I think it's well, I hope it's unlikely to change things too much, but we have to see.
So in principle, you can just simply include the bootstrap equations of the path.
Right, yeah, I wasn't planning to talk about that, but there are some tricks you could do, but it's not obvious how to do it. But it is actually, well, we can talk about it later, but yeah, it's a bit weird.
So maybe I missed, or maybe you were about to say, so if you're basically using crossing on a defect,
yeah,
then how are you inputting all this bulk information?
Right, we'll see. So the key is that we're not only having correlation functions of operators on the defect, but we have correlation functions of these endpoints. So when we have an endpoint, well, we can, if we take a tiny segment of endpoint, then we can expand it in terms of bulk local operators. So this connects the defect to the bulk. This is what connects the defect to the bulk.
So this means that the endpoint operator is the only type of junction operator that you're including in your external set?
In this talk, yeah, but I've played around with including the domain walls and stuff like that too.
But then it will be hard to insert sigma and epsilon on a segment that isn't between two endpoints, right?
No, because actually, if you can have two endpoints, one domain wall, and a bulk. That's a valid. That's a perfectly fine correlator. You could do that, or you could have one endpoint and you could have two endpoints, one defect operator and a bulk operator. So you can actually combine all these different operator types into any four-point function you want.
Okay, as long as the endpoint is somewhere in the system, then this is well defined.
Yeah, exactly. So as long as the endpoint is somewhere, then it will appear in a correlation function with, well, it'll expand. It'll either be expanded in bulk operators, or there'd even be a bulk operator around to fuse with it as an external operator. So, but we also include pure bulk operators, and if we were including these domain walls or the defect operators, we'd also include correlation functions only involving those guys. So we just consider all. We enumerate all possible correlation functions of these. Well, here we just have three external operators, but in general, we may have like up to five or something like that. But you know, including the domain wall and the defect operator, it doesn't seem to do that much. It's almost as good to just treat it as a discrete internal constraint in Bootstrap. So it's almost not worth it, it seems. But I need to test that out a bit more. So I'm actually kind of running out of time. It looks like a little bit, but I started slightly late. But so maybe I'll skip a bunch of this. Basically, what we're doing here is just considering all the possible OPEs of these different operators and exploring what kinds of operators will appear in the OPE. One thing that's kind of nice that we do related to Yinchen's question is we use the fact that even though we're considering these bulk operators as defect operators on the trivial defect, we still want to incorporate the 3D symmetry, because they are operators that have 3D symmetry. So for some reasons, it's hard to just directly put in the full four-point function. That's the function of like two cross ratios. You can imagine the OPE coefficients would still appear in the same way. But the point is that, well, maybe I glossed over this. The point is that if I have an endpoint fusing to bulk operators, O need not be a bulk primary. And so all the descendants of O would have different OPE coefficients with the endpoint. And so if you can't just like put in the full 3D four-point function of the bulk pure bulk operators and couple these in easily with the system. But there is a trick that Max came up with, which I think is very cute, which is, well, I can tell people about it later, but it's funny. But we haven't done that yet. But to try to get a bit of bulk symmetry, we basically realize that, if we take this kind of correlation function, then this correlation function has full bulk symmetry, and so if we look at we can look at the descendants of this operator and then exactly compute their OPE coefficients relative to the OPE coefficient of the external operators here. And you find some operator which is an SL2R primary that's also a bulk descendant, and then you get this OPE coefficient, and you can put this information in. And it actually does quite a bit to strengthen the balance. Okay. So basically here are all the types of correlation functions that we consider. So we consider 4-point functions of pure endpoint operators. Again, the crossing symmetry kind of is like acting as a cyclic permutation. So we can schematically represent the crossing symmetry as just shifting all these operators by one position. And so here what we're doing is relating endpoint operators fusing to bulk local operators to endpoint operators fusing to defect operators, since we basically just shrink these two guys that are enclosed in the circle down to nothing. We do the same thing here where we have two different finite segments of the endpoint of the defect with different signs. And in this channel, they would fuse again to bulk operators, but in this channel, they would fuse to domain walls. And then here, we consider correlation functions of some segment of defect with bulk operators. And here, we would again fuse to bulk operators. Here, of course, we fuse to bulk operators. And here, we fuse to other endpoint operators. So let's now show what we get after going through all this trouble. So first, what I'll show is that with basically no other assumptions other than the fact that we expect that this symmetry broken defect is stable in to local perturbations, we can get an island in the scaling dimension of the endpoint and this this G function. So this is a very general calculation. So the bounds we have are not extremely precise. But nonetheless, what we see is that along this island, G is less than 1 for all points in the island. You might want to conclude then that the true pinning field defect of the Ising model would live somewhere in this island because it's symmetry. I'm assuming it's symmetry broken. And it has G less than 1, which we would expect from the perturbation we make in the UV. Interestingly, if you look at this highest precision curve here, so each shrinking region is a higher precision calculation. If you look at this highest one here, actually G is greater than 1 for all points in this peninsula up to the dimension that I've shown here. So that's kind of cool because it means that in order to have sort of a perturbative defect, I would need to have the endpoint dimension even bigger than here. So we have some kind of lower bound on the endpoint dimension for sort of perturbative defects after we get past this island. We can now study some other things. So we can look at the scaling dimension of the lightest defect operator. So here we're really making no assumptions about the defect. I guess in all these calculations, we assume that the external endpoint operator is the lightest endpoint operator among all of the S equals 0 endpoint operators. But that's really the only assumption we make about the defect. And now with all these assumptions about the bulk, OPE coefficients, and et cetera, we get some curve like this. So from this plot, we can extract an upper bound on the scaling dimension of the lightest defect operator, which is like 1.72. And if you remember, the predictions from various groups, Monte Carlo, Fuzzy Sphere, analytic stuff, it was between like 1.4 and 1.65. So this is just the maximum of this plot. But actually, if we look at like here, we see that everywhere else, the bounds are kind of drifting quite substantially. But if you look right here, there's some point where the bounds seem to not want to get passed. And roughly, this point corresponds to this point. And so in particular, the...
You mean?
Oh, 1.6714. Yeah. Sorry. So there should be a 1. The fuzzy sphere prediction for the endpoint was like something like 1.107 x. And so, you know, that's fairly promising, I'd say. And also, this is, I think, quite close to the fuzzy sphere prediction as well. Hello? Okay. So now we can move on to the domain wall. So what we see is that when the endpoint dimension is very small, then the domain wall must be highly relevant. So in order to talk about this bound on spontaneous symmetry breaking, we should look, for instance, at where this endpoint dimension crosses 1. And that occurs when the endpoint dimension is roughly 0.13. But the island I showed earlier, the upper bound for the endpoint was like 0.12. And so from this, what we could conclude is that no matter where the true defect lives on this island, it must have a relevant domain wall. So what we can say is that in 3D, this defect is unstable to the domain wall, and long-range order is not possible. Again, we see like a very close results to the fuzzy sphere for both of these quantities, which is quite interesting.
So in this plot, you don't assume anything?
Yeah, I don't assume anything. Again, except just this like lightest endpoint, etc. Yeah, these are sort of very crude. These are very crude calculations. So one striking thing we find is if we look at the bound on the lightest subleading endpoint operator, then there's this very like sharp peak. I didn't get around to putting in what the numbers are here, but it turns out that this peak is, you know, this was also reported the other day in John's talk, and it's like, well, I don't want to say, but it's very close to what you guys reported. And what I'm hoping is that when I study this plot more closely, in particular, I want to do some spectrum extraction near this peak. I'm hoping that this will really tell us where the defect is, but we have to see. Okay, so the last plot I'll show is what we get when we start making some more assumptions about the defect spectrum. And these assumptions are motivated by our previous results about the gaps for these defect operators. And so if we assume these gaps in the spectrum of defect operators and domain walls, which I'd say, based on all the evidence we have, are fairly conservative, we get basically the endpoint and the G to within like 1 to 5%, respectively. Or sorry, the other way around. I think it's 5% for the endpoint and 1% for the G. So we pretty much know now what these quantities are for this defect. And I should say that like the prediction for the fuzzy sphere is like somewhere in the island, at least. Okay, so I'll conclude by just summarizing. So I hope what I've shown is that by including some new sectors of operators, we can learn a lot more about line defects in CFTs. I think it's exciting that, well, maybe we can convince ourselves both with fuzzy sphere and the bootstrap that we're not crazy and we're getting similar results, which is nice. So what's left to do, hopefully it won't take too long, but is to carefully look at the spectra that we can derive using various techniques. From these G bounds, we really already have spectra, but it was kind of hard to gather much from them. Another thing we could do that'd be easy is to impose gaps above the first gap of in the plus plus and plus minus sector. This should like really shrink the island G, so that'd be nice. But there are also like various exciting directions that I think I hope to think about soon. Which in particular I'm really interested in the problem of spin impurities. Probably fuzzy sphere and bootstrap are like the real ways to do this. Perturbative techniques are kind of hard, and I mean, I guess you could do Monte Carlo, but those are probably, to get good results, maybe you have to do quite expensive computations. So I think that'd be really, really cool, and especially bounds on the defect entropy there would be interesting, because there are all sorts of phases that you can have for these impurities, where they're either screened or decoupled or et cetera, and so you could, with G bounds, you could really say like constraints on when these defects must be decoupled and screened, et cetera. Like, so that'd be cool. And then further, if we study gauge theories or something, then we can try to do these tricks for Wilson lines. And there they might have some more interesting symmetry properties. And so I think there'd be some interesting things to do there. Okay, so I think that's it. So thank you for listening, and sorry for being a bit late and getting out of time, but so thank you.
So we have time for about 2 questions.
I was just wondering, out of curiosity, what do you mean by spin impurities?
Yeah, so it's like you have some lattice system of spins. Like you could take like a Heisenberg model in whatever dimension you want. There's various things you can do. So your system already has like SO3 symmetry, so it's very natural to like add another spin, add some new spin of any SO3 spin you want, and couple it in symmetrically somehow, and then ask if there's some new fixed points. You can also look at vacancies. So this is just where you create some like lattice defect basically, and then now this vacancy will be it'll be a defect, and so you can try to study it with. So I don't exactly know how you'd tell the difference between a vacancy and an extra spin half or something like that in Bootstrap, but that's what I have in mind.
Sorry, when you say SO3, may I ask what you're referring to?
The SO3 internal spin of the spins.
Okay.
Thanks for the question.
I was also wondering, what's sorry, not bad.
I was just going to ask, what was Max's trick for accounting for the descendants?
Right. So you basically include the bulk. You include the bulk correlators twice, basically. So you first include the bulk correlators as like 1D correlators. And then you include them a second time as full 3D correlators, but they're kind of more decoupled. So you're kind of, and so then what you do is like you can, there's just sort of these extra components where you have like sort of almost decoupled contributions from these different OPE coefficients of the leading operators. So you know all those exactly, and you can see it. You basically don't run into this issue where there's coupling of the bulk descendants to the endpoints, because you've just like kind of completely, maybe that was a bit confusing. I haven't thought about that in a while. Maybe we should talk about it afterwards, but I'll be able to recall it better. But
yeah, me too.
Does that make sense roughly? Like,
not why it would work, but
yeah. Well, it's something you can do. It's unclear whether it would actually do anything, because it's kind of. It seems like more decoupled than you'd like, but it still seems like something good to try.
There might also be some sort of word identities involving the displacement operator and bulk things. Since you could say, okay, the whole thing should be translation invariant, maybe I can take a derivative of the bulk operator or insert the displacement somewhere online.
You mean like
the Lucas conformal transformation fixes the endpoints of the line defect and moves the middle a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
you could represent it as an integrating the displacement between the two points. And it would also be moving the bound point. So maybe that could be a constraint between endpoint displacement bound.
So are you saying that correlator should be like fixed basically or something?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds interesting. I haven't thought about that.
So out of curiosity, what does data collection look like as you mentioned, like a bottom process?
What?
So this is not, there's experimental evidence for this, right? Like I'm not super familiar with ICP.
Yeah, experiments or, you mean like real experiments? I asked like at least one experimentalist about this, and I think she was like, I mean, maybe I think it's like hard to just like create a very isolated magnetic field, or a very localized magnetic field. But I think there are situations in like liquids and stuff like where you can do this more naturally, but I don't know all the details of that.
Okay. I was just thinking in the car earlier, like one analysis that I like for icing is when you have like popsicle sticks or dominoes, and you flip one of them and it like propagates outwards, but then it doesn't quite have the same like spin thing. It's just something I've
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you, like when you flick one popsicle stick and then the kinetic energy makes the whole thing go like, it propagates outwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well,
It's completely different, but it's just like an image I like to think about.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think the trouble experimentally is just how to create this localized excitation. Because well, here we have like a 3D bulk system.
Does it matter how you create it?
As long as you create it.
Well, no, I guess.
But
then somehow you need to. What was that?
I mean, anything you do there that breaks the symmetry will flow here, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But I guess how do you do it sufficiently localized? Like, I mean, somehow like if you have like a if I really have like a liquid, like well, I don't know, what do I do to like stick this thing through? I don't know. But maybe if you have like a quantum, like maybe if you have some model like a quantum magnet that's in the icing universality class. I don't know if there's any. There's like magnetic probes that you can have, and that should actually be the same thing. But like, I don't know how sensitive those are. Like, I don't know if it really would. I don't know. But yeah, I think in principle this stuff is like something that you could compare to experiments. Indeed, and I think that'd be cool.
I guess we have enough questions.
Okay.